doubt I'll really be able to put my jacket on again until September. I get too warmed up when I'm reading to the kids. One more second here. I've got to find my voice recorder.
It's on the right.
Oh, it's on the right? Okay, it is running too. Okay, wonderful. We lost our voice recorder sometime in the last 2 weeks, as well as our cordless mic. So if anyone's seen them, please let us know. Sendai Gibbon was a Zen monk known for his sense of humor, his ability to explain difficult teachings, and for his calligraphic paintings. The most famous of these calligraphy works shows a circle, a triangle, and a square. It's also possible that it's a painting of a square, a triangle, and a circle. And then again, since it's a Zen painting, it might be best to describe from the center to the sides as a triangle, a circle, and a square. D.T. Suzuki, the great interpreter of Zen for Westerners, said, "The circle represents the infinite, and the infinite is the basis of all beings. But the infinite in itself is formless. We humans, endowed with senses and intellect, demand tangible forms. Hence, the triangle. The triangle is the beginning of all forms. Out of it first comes the square. The square is the triangle doubled. This doubling process, which is so much fun in children's stories, goes on infinitely." So maybe the painting was like a diagram about things unfolding in a certain order, a chart, or maybe it tells a story. I think you could see that too. Do we have a picture up on the screen? It's kind of small and hard to see, but there's our famous painting. The most famous, how about that for your most famous work? I think you can see all of that. Sengai himself left no title or description, but that painting has come to be called The Universe. I wonder if the real explanation might be that Sengai was just having fun with his viewers by making them stop and ponder. Why those objects? Why that order? Why any objects in any order? Here's a story about Sengai that I like very much. A rich man asked Sengai to write something for the continued prosperity of his family so that it might be treasured from generation to generation. Sengai got a large sheet of paper and wrote, "Father dies, son dies, grandson dies." The rich man was furious. "I asked you to write something for the happiness of my family. Why do you make a joke like this?" He had no doubt been expecting something about how great his family was at present, how noble it had always been, and how esteemed it would remain. But no joke is intended, explained Sengai. "If before you yourself die, your son should die, this would grieve you greatly. If your grandson should pass away before your son, both of you would be brokenhearted. If your family, generation after generation, passes away in the order I have named, it will be the natural course of life. And I call this real prosperity." There's no doubt that Sengai wants us to think about the order of things in what we call the universe. I've got a feeling that he'd like us to put some thought into their balance as well. Now the choir is going to sing for us hymn number, 1002 in the teal hymnal. And the choir has invited you all to join in and sing along after the first verse of "Comfort Me." Resources, that's part of it, but even those inner resources, you need to be courteous to yourself when you ask for them, you know, when you want to mobilize those resources. Well, when Tia Anna, my great aunt Annie, died some years ago, I wasn't upset at all. Don't get me wrong, I loved her, I grieved for her, and I'll always miss her. Aunt Annie was what you'd call a character, a playful peasant, like the funny little woman in my story, who could never stop chuckling at the abundance of her old age in America compared to the poverty of her youth in southern Italy. When I was a teenager, my best friend's father was Aunt Annie's doctor. I remember him once taking me aside and saying, "Tell your aunt never to do what she did to me again." I asked him what had happened. This was weird. And he told me that she'd gone to the emergency room in the middle of the night before thinking she had a heart attack. She wouldn't let anyone but her own physician, an Italian, touch her. And he had to get up at 3 a.m. to go to her side. When he examined Aunt Annie, he found no signs of cardiac problems. So he asked her what she'd eaten the night before. "You know, this and that, and a few peperoncini," she told him, and so he asked her how many pepperoncini she'd consumed. "No, I guess I ate it the whole jar." "Never again," Dr. Maganini told me to tell her, "never again with the pepperoncini." Even after 50 years in this country, she still sometimes had trouble coping with the abundance around her, a whole jar of something, anything that was hers for the taking. At that time, I was living with my grandmother, Annie's sister-in-law, and her brother's widow, and the two spoke on the phone every day. Or I should say that every day the two participated in the most amazing system of language learning that I have ever witnessed. If I happened to be home in the afternoon, my nonna would say to me at some point, "Okay, I can't talk no more, it's time for my stories." What she meant by her stories were the daytime soap operas on TV. She'd turn on the set, sit down, then immediately pick up the phone and call Tia Anna. Aunt Annie would be sitting at home with her own set tuned to the same story, and the two of them would keep up a running commentary. My grandmother's English was much better than Annie's, so she would guide her through difficult figures of speech and the complex plot lines. Who's cheating on who? Who's dying? Who do we think was dead, but now they've come back to complicate the lives of their loved ones who've made peace with them being gone? Soap operas. So now what? Over time, Aunt Annie's English remained heavily accented. She still had grammatical errors, but it was fluent. It flowed out like water. It came from learning through stories, a brilliant language learning system using no charts or diagrams, something like Rosetta Stone tries to be. Once at a cousin's wedding, Aunt Annie called me over to her table. Figlio mio, bene qua. When a senior relative calls to you at an Italian wedding, what do?
Come.
You go. You go. So you want to get married too? She asked me. Sure, Aunt Annie, if you're still available. Not me, Svachi, my talk about you cousin. But she just got married today. Not her, stupido. You got a cousin in Italy. She ready to get married. She want to come over. I fix the things up for you. She met a cousin once or twice removed, not a first cousin. That's pretty common in Italy, I guess, and that's why, whatever else I may think about Rudy Giuliani as a political figure, I don't hold his marriage to his second cousin against him. But that's also not for me. No thanks, Aunt Annie. I'll keep looking. I'm glad that I did. And I'm sorry that Aunt Annie never got to meet my wife, Pamela. But I'm not overwhelmed with sorrow that she died when she did. This is not only because she lived to the age of 95. It's because her death seemed to be perfectly in order, like a leaf falling from a tree in late autumn. She died almost to the day, 31 years after my father had died while still in his 40s. She died 10 years after one of my first cousins did. Not the marrying kind, but one of my generation, not removed at all from me, still in her early 50s, lung cancer. These two deaths were perfectly out of order. They're the kinds of death that upset our sense of how things are supposed to be, that throw them into confusion, that make us ask questions. Why her? Why him? Why in that order? It's silly in a way. We all understand that the end can come for at any time for anyone, or at least we think we understand. Then it happens and we realize that we never really understood any such thing at all. I tell my wife that I forbid her to die even one day less than 6 years after me, since she's 6 years younger. She thinks I'm joking. My son is forbidden to ever die at all. How could I feel otherwise? How could I not have a certain order in mind? The Prophet Muhammad and his first wife Khadija had a total of 6 children. The first was a boy who died before he was 2. 4 daughters grew to adulthood, but 3 died before their father. His last child with Khadija was another boy who died in infancy. Only when Khadija died after 25 years of marriage did he begin to take other wives, a total of 12 eventually, including several elderly widows in need of support. Of the younger women, one was Jewish and another Christian. Late in his life, his Christian wife had a son, whom she named Ibrahim, or Abraham, after her own father. Muhammad doted on the little boy in that grandfatherly way of many older dads, I know wherever I speak. But just as he was beginning to walk and talk, Ibrahim also fell sick and died. The Prophet was beside himself with grief, and it was a long time before he could even find his voice again. After he had delivered the funeral prayer for Ibrahim, he reached down to smooth the soil of the little grave with his hand. And people asked him, oh, should we all do this too? The same thing at funerals. He said, doing this does neither harm nor good, but it gives relief to the soul of the afflicted. Giving the soil, the earth, the planet, little bit of loving order. And then he said, conduct yourself in this world as if you were here to stay forever. And at the same time, prepare for eternity as if you have to die tomorrow. Is that how most of us conduct ourselves? Really? Forever. Forever. That means no running out the clock on what you know you should do but haven't done. Tomorrow. That comes in a little under 13 hours, folks. Live as if you will live forever, and at the same time live as if you will die tomorrow. We normally don't like to be reminded of death or of eternity, but Muhammad brought them up during the course of a religious service, and we can accept that. It would probably even be fine with us if someone leading such a service were to ask us to take some deep breaths, remembering on the in-breath to think, live forever. And on the out-breath, die tomorrow. Live forever. Die tomorrow. Live forever. Die tomorrow. They could even ask us to keep this in mind with every in-breath and out-breath once a day for 5 minutes or five times daily for only one. And tell us that such a practice can change your life if you take it to heart. Because it can. The awareness builds on itself like rice grains in the old woman's pot. Talking life and death outside of religious services is another matter, even for religious leaders. There's a difference between religious services and daily life, after all, isn't there? I think I get the difference. Some religious leaders don't. Interestingly enough, neither do some political leaders. I can think of two who've been elected president, Jimmy Carter and Al Gore. As president, Carter wanted to call this nation to something like a ritual of reflection, even repentance, as he spoke about our national malaise after Watergate and the Vietnam War. Al Gore, a real veteran of that war, is one of the easiest public figures in the world to make fun of, wearing his pain and concern right on his sleeve and in the tone of his voice. He never seems to have learned the simple trick of telling voters how great they are, always have been, and always will be. Hooray for you, hooray for me, hooray for us, USA, USA, beautiful. Instead, he wants us to recognize our involvement in an unflattering story about what has happened, is happening, and what else will happen soon unless we take an active interest in this story. This story. And an active role in changing it. In his Academy Award-winning movie, An Inconvenient Truth, he shares a profound observation about how many people respond to the information he presents. Some reverse positions very quickly, says Gore, and they go from denial to despair. Oh God, it's so bad, there's nothing we can do. He also tells us that two events which helped him motivate his work on the human role in global climate change were the death of his sister from lung cancer and the near death of his son when he was hit by a car at the age of 6. His story with these out of order events, both linked to smoke and cars, took him from the personal to the global. You could even say that it's how he got religion. Religion, at its best, moves us from the personal to the global, from the body to the planet, from me or you to the world we share together in an interdependent web. And then it moves us back again. Religion, at its best, tries to help us cultivate a sense of balance between what it identifies as two of the most powerful human tendencies, pride and despair, or arrogance and hopelessness. No religion is content to leave us full of pride or self-satisfaction, confident that I myself am the crown of creation, the be-all and the end-all. But neither should we despair. There is a way out, a way up, like the old woman found, a way through to safety, if I will faithfully follow this teaching or that. Just be careful not to lunge from one extreme to the other and wind up getting stuck in the web in the middle of prideful hopefulness or a mixed up arrogant despair. Those are real. Prideful hopefulness or arrogant despair. To be stuck in the middle, is not balance. And balance is what religion at its best is about teaching and learning. Live forever, die tomorrow, stand at the center or stand at the edge. Just stay alert. Stay poised. Poise is a good word. Poise is a living, active kind of balance. Alert, aware, engaged. It's a listening, feeling kind of balance in motion. It's not like erecting a rigid structure that will stand all on its own for all time. Tsengai, the calligrapher monk, was asked to write something permanent to be hung on a rich man's wall to ensure his family's prosperity from generation to generation. And so he wrote, "Father dies, son dies, grandson dies." He also drew a circle, a triangle, and a square, though we don't know in what order or what he meant by doing so. They might have been the moon, a mountain, and garden inside of a fence. Our late, great Northwest novelist, Ursula K. Le Guin, speaks through one of her characters in a story called Solitude. She says, "I never knew anybody, anywhere I've been, who found life simple. I think a life or a time looks simple when you leave out the details. The way a planet looks smooth from orbit." Oh, who we've lost. Smooth. No volcanoes of passion or anger. No fields of flowers and sweetness. No oceans of tears. Chasms of loss and emptiness or deserts of solitude. A world that's in the order we find it, the order as it comes, is never smooth. If all of us die in the exact order in which we were born, each person neatly finishing their turn in the world before the next one's turn came around, wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be nice? But what kind of story would that make? It might provide a handsome diagram or chart, but it wouldn't be a story at all. Maybe we could learn a language from such a chart, but no one could understand it. No one in this world where things happen as they happen. In your stories, or mine, or Aunt Annie's. Stories let us share a language of joy and sorrow. At Aunt Annie's funeral, I could feel her life again as I heard stories about her that I'd never heard before. I laughed when I heard from her son how he'd once gotten a call from the local Sears store to please come get his mother, who was there causing trouble. The trouble? The trouble was that she wanted to bargain at Sears the way you did in the old country. "Sure, I know that's the price you tell me, but this is the price I offer." Right? What's wrong with having a little conversation about it, a little give and take? I don't know what the item was. A purse, a washing machine, probably not a jar of pepperoncini. Not Sears, anyway. I could feel a bit of her life flowing through me as I recalled her offer to fix things up before me, to marry some second or third cousin from the old country. Not many people, not many there, not many other family members knew about the incredible language learning system that she worked out with my grandmother, talking together from separate houses as they both took in the same stories. Maybe I should patent that idea and call it Rosetta Phone. Yeah, it was easy to laugh at Aunt Annie's funeral. She'd been 95 years old, after all, and a character. But you hear laughter at services for young people as well. Those who have died out of order, way out of order, before their time and before ours as well. That's okay. We use a lot of the same muscles when we laugh as when we cry. And each gets us ready for the other, the way breathing in prepares us to breathe out, as the out does for the in. Whether it's a wedding or memorial, potluck meal or Sunday service, I'm glad that there's a place where we can come together to exercise these muscles with both our tears and laughter, where the glare of pride and the darkness of despair can be distilled into a clear and steady light, where we can share stories of times that were, times we hope for, and the times we're living through together. We may live forever or die tomorrow, or all of the living and dying that remain for us might happen in the next breath coming in or going out. As the out does for the in. You can't be sure. You can't bargain with life or death any more than you can bargain at Sears. But you're invited to make the best of it. Right here, right now, and in all your days, your hours, your minutes, and your seconds still to come. May they be rich and joyous for you and for yours.